Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to cutting through the noise and really extracting the most surprising insights from any topic. Today, we're doing just that. We're plunging into an ancient text that's, well, it's remarkably short, but absolutely packed with urgency.
It really is.
And unexpected relevance for our world today. We're talking about the letter of Jude.
Yeah, a little powerhouse.
It's like a compact, fiery manifesto from the first century. Our deep dive today is inspired by Dr. David A. DeSilva's fantastic work on 7 Peter and Jude.
Great resource.
And our mission, really, is to decode Jude's unique style, understand his potent message, and maybe uncover some of the fascinating detective work involved in bringing his words to life across millennia.
And what's truly fascinating here, I think, is how Jude, in just 25 verses, manages a kind of masterclass in ancient persuasion.
Right.
It's brief, yes. But it offers you, the listener, a profound shortcut. You get insight into ancient letter writing, rhetorical strategies, and these timeless warnings about protecting community integrity.
And that relevance today is key.
Exactly. The surprising nugget. Jude's playbook for spotting danger within a group is startlingly relevant, even thousands of years later.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Jude is called a letter. But when we talk about letters from the Greco-Roman world, what does that really mean? Was Jude unique? I mean, how does it stack up against, say, Paul's much longer epistles that many of us are familiar with?
That's a crucial starting point. You know, we tend to think of Paul's letters as the norm, but Jude's length, that's actually far more typical.
Oh, really?
Yeah, far more comparable to the mass of letters surviving from, you know, the real life use of letters back then. People weren't usually writing these huge treatises disguised as letters.
Okay.
In fact, ancient scribes even had these handbooks, like style guides, essentially.
Right.
And they listed dozens of distinct letter types. You had things like an advisory letter recommending action, or a letter of recommendation, a friendly letter, even a letter of reprimand.
It's like templates almost.
Pretty much. And Jude, well, Jude turns out to be a bit of a hybrid.
A hybrid, you say. So what kind of letter is Jude specifically? Is it just like a tough love letter?
You could definitely call it that. Tough love fits. Technically, though, it's a mixed type. Its primary aim is advisory.
Okay.
Jude is urging his audience, you know, contend for the faith, build yourselves up, stay focused on God's mercy, help each other stay on course.
Standard encouragement stuff.
Right. But he's also fiercely dissuading them from falling for the temptations of these troublemakers who've slipped into their community.
The interlopers.
Exactly. And here's the interesting part. While the main goal is advice, Jude actually dedicates more words to his secondary purpose, which is vituperative. It means laying bare bad character, condemning offensive actions.
Wow. Okay. So strong stuff.
Very strong. He's not just warning. He's actively condemning these people. But all that condemnation, you see, it serves the larger advisory goal. He has to show the danger clearly.
That direct language, that clear intent to persuade.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder, is there like a natural overlap between this kind of letter and classical rhetoric? You know, the art of public speaking?
Oh, absolutely. A huge overlap. Think of it this way. Jude is doing what ancient rhetoricians called deliberative oratory.
Deliberative?
Yeah. It's all about persuading a group to adopt or avoid a certain course of action, like a politician arguing for or against a policy.
Makes sense.
But because he's also so focused on exposing the bad character of these interlopers, he's also dipping into what they called epideictic oratory.
Epideictic?
Mm-hmm. That's the genre focused on praise or blame. Think of a eulogy praising someone, or a, you know, a blistering critique of their flaws.
So he's using both praise and blame.
Yeah.
Well, mostly blame here.
Mostly blame for the interlopers, yes. Jude is basically using every rhetorical trick in the book, any and all deliberative strategies, any and all epideictic strategies to convince his audience.
Given that powerful feel, like a public address almost, how does Jude actually end his letter? Is it like a typical personal note, say hi to so-and-so, or more like a sermon?
It definitely ends more like a sermon. You won't find Jude talking about his travel plans or sending personal greetings or asking for anything mundane.
No, hope this letter finds you well.
Not at all. Instead, he concludes with this powerful doxology, a hymn of praise to God.
Oh.
And this strongly suggests the likely setting for his letter's delivery. It wasn't just read privately. It was almost certainly read aloud to the whole congregation during a worship gathering. It's formal, it's communal.
That makes so much sense. And it really brings up a core theme that runs through the whole letter, doesn't it?
Mm.
Jude seems incredibly concerned with boundaries.
Yes, very much so.
What's the fundamental tension he's navigating for his audience by emphasizing those boundaries so strongly?
Well, Jude is wrestling with a tension that frankly still resonates today. It's this inherent push and pull, right? Between a kind of progressive impulse, people feeling personally led by God's Spirit, maybe towards new freedoms or insights.
Right, it's the new revelation idea.
Exactly. And then the conservative essence of revealed religion, which holds firm to the core faith delivered once for all, as Jude puts it.
We see that tension elsewhere too.
Oh, yeah. Paul grapples with similar issues, you know, defending Christian freedom, but always warning against crossing lines that would dishonor God.
So how does Jude see the interlopers fitting into this?
For Jude, the crux is how these interlopers radically misunderstand God's grace. They see it as a license, basically.
A free pass.
A free pass to indulge their fleshly cravings without consequence. But Jude insists grace isn't that at all. It's meant to set people on a trajectory toward blamelessness.
Towards transformation.
Precisely, so they can stand before God's glory without shame. Grace, for Jude, is about transformation, not permission for license. Big difference.
Okay, so let's talk about how he builds his case. Jude starts his argument against these interlopers by looking squarely at the past. Why were historical examples such a powerful tool for persuasion back then?
Well, imagine trying to convince someone to do something, or maybe not do something. The most effective way was often to show them what happened to others who took similar paths.
Like case studies.
Exactly. Historical examples were like ancient case studies. When advising future actions, you'd point to past figures, good or bad, to illustrate the consequences.
Makes sense. Show, don't just tell.
Right. And when you were praising someone or criticizing them, you'd compare them to heroes or villains from history. It established their honor or their disgrace. It's the ultimate lessons learned approach.
So what does this mean for Jude's strategy here? He's not just, like, giving a history lesson, is he?
No, not at all. He's much more strategic than that. Jude isn't just recalling sacred history. He's deliberately shining an interpretive light on these interlopers. He's helping his audience draw these immediate, unavoidable connections between those ancient lessons and their present situation. He even says, basically, you already know this stuff.
Right, verse 5.
Yeah. He makes it clear this material isn't new to them. They know these stories. His genius is in making the necessary connections for them so they can apply that knowledge advantageously right now. He's showing them the past is a mirror for their present moment.
Okay, so Jude lays out this powerful series of examples in verses 5 to 7. Let's start with the first one he uses, the Exodus generation. How does he use their story as a warning?
Right, so Jude immediately takes his audience back to that story in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. This was the generation God miraculously delivered from slavery in Egypt.
Fed them manna, gave them water.
Exactly. Provided for them in the desert, brought them right to the edge of the promised land. But then remember, 10 of the 12 spies came back with a negative report.
Despite Joshua and Caleb saying, let's go.
Right. And the people chose to believe the majority report. They turned against Moses and Aaron, even accused God of bringing them out there maliciously.
Big mistake.
Huge. The consequence was swift and devastating. Gus declared that every Hebrew adult who rejected his promise, who believed the bad report, would die in the desert.
Which led to
another 38 years of wandering. So Jude uses this to hammer home a fundamental point. God's deliverance, even miraculous deliverance, isn't some kind of guarantee of future favor if you abandon faith and obedience later on. Past blessing doesn't equal future license.
And Jude looks even further back for his next example. The rebel angels. Now, this isn't just straight out of Genesis, is it? This feels like a story that gave, well, an upgrade somewhere along the line.
You're absolutely right. It's definitely an upgrade. Well, Genesis 6, verses 1 to 4, briefly mentions angels mating with human women.
The Nephilim story.
Yeah, that story. It was significantly expanded in later Jewish literature, particularly in texts like 1 Enoch and Jubilees, which were circulating around the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE.
So what did those later texts add?
They paint a much fuller picture. These accounts describe angels rebelling against God's created order, transgressing their boundaries by having relations with human females.
And the result?
They supposedly birthed a race of giants who just wreaked havoc. And these fallen angels also taught humanity forbidden arts, things like mining metals, which led to greed, forging weapons, even cosmetics to incite desire.
Wow. So they corrupted humanity.
That's the idea in those texts. God had to intervene, kill the giants. Their spirits became demons, according to the story, and the angels themselves. They were chained and locked away in deep, dark caverns.
Which Jude mentions.
Exactly. Jude specifically recalls that detail, chained in dark caverns, which you don't find in Genesis 6 at all. Some even see possible influence from Greek myths here, like the Titans.
That's interesting.
And many Jewish authors use this story to explain the origin of evil and chaos in the world. The lesson Jude draws is crystal clear. Those who cross the lines God has drawn, even heavenly beings, come to a bad end. Defiance has consequences.
Okay, then what about Sodom and Gomorrah? How does Jude connect their fiery fate to the interlopers he's warning his audience about?
Sodom and Gomorrah were, a very popular negative example, a cautionary tale in Jewish literature. They were known for their unique destruction fire raining down from the sky.
A memorable end.
Definitely. And Jude specifically censures them for committing fornication and going after a different kind of flesh. Now that phrasing, different kind of flesh, is really loaded.
How so? What does it imply?
Well, it's the same sort of language Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15 when he's contrasting our physical bodies now with our future resurrection bodies.
Ah, so like unnatural flesh.
Exactly. For Jude, it seems to powerfully evoke the idea of an unnatural transgressive desire. Specifically, connecting back to Genesis 19, the attempt by the men of Sodom to rape the angelic messengers.
So it's a parallel to the angel sin in Genesis 6.
Precisely. It links directly to the sin of the angels, a desire for a fleshly connection outside divinely ordained boundaries. So again, Jude is just hammering home the grim consequences of crossing God-ordained lines for life and practice. Don't cross the boundaries.
So bringing all these ancient stories together, the disobedient generation, the rebel angels, Sodom, how does Jude then specifically apply these lessons to the interlopers he's warning against in his own community?
Yeah.
What are their characteristics, according to Jude?
Right. He pulls it all together in verse 8. He basically says, these people are just like them. And he describes them first as people who go about dreaming.
Dreaming. What does that mean?
Well, that's interesting because it's not directly from the preceding examples. So there's a very good chance this reflects an actual observable practice of the interlopers themselves.
Like claiming visions or something.
Exactly. Likely claiming, perhaps even staging charismatic experiences as their source of authority. You know, like the false prophets warned about in Deuteronomy.
Okay, what else?
He also says they pollute flesh. That points pretty clearly to self-indulgence, often with clear sexual overtones based on the context.
Right.
They are setting aside authority or denying lordship, which means they're pushing this idea of Christian freedom so far that it moves into the territory of license and licentiousness, a danger Paul also warned about frequently.
And the last one.
Slandering glories. This one's a bit more mysterious.
Glories, like bragging.
Possibly, but it's more likely heard here as a reference to an order of angels, or maybe angels in general.
So disrespecting angels, why would they do that?
Couple of possibilities. Maybe they claimed freedom from all moral constraints, even those upheld by divine beings. Or perhaps they were acting as if they enjoyed authority over spiritual beings, maybe dabbling in magic or exorcisms, acting like charlatans. Kind of like Simon the Magician among the Samaritans back in Acts chapter 8.
Okay. This raises another question. Because Jude then drops an even more obscure example, Michael the archangel disputing with Satan over Moses' body. What on earth is that about? And I guess, what's the most unexpected thing this really obscure story reveals?
Yeah, this is definitely one of those moments that makes the letter feel a bit less accessible to us today. Why? Because no written sources from the Second Temple period that might fully shed light on this specific story. Well, none have survived.
So we're piecing it together.
We are. The general belief, based on fragments and later references, is this. Moses died, burial place unknown, right? A legend developed that angels themselves buried him to keep the location hidden, maybe prevent idolatry.
Okay.
The dispute then was between Michael, as God's representative, and Satan. Satan apparently argued Moses shouldn't have an honorable burial because he'd been a murderer back in Egypt.
Right, when he killed the Egyptian.
Exactly. Yeah. But Michael prevailed. But here's the key part, the surprising revelation, maybe. Michael's restraint.
What do you mean?
Even though he's the archangel, he didn't rebuke Satan on his own authority. He deferred to God, saying simply, "May the Lord rebuke you."
And that phrase pops up elsewhere.
It does. Very similar phrase in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 2. Another heavenly debate scene between the devil and an angel over a human being, the high priest Joshua.
Wow. And you mentioned 2 Peter draws on Jude.
Heavily. But interestingly, the author of 2 Peter actually omitted reference to this specific story completely, which just highlights how maybe foreign or obscure it might have seemed even relatively soon after Jude wrote.
That is fascinating. So, okay, how does Jude use this obscure example of angelic restraint to deliver, as you put it earlier, an artful slam against the interlopers?
Ah, he hits them hard in verse 10. Listen to this. But these people slander whatever things they do not comprehend.
Okay, like the glories, the angels.
Right. But those things that they do comprehend naturally, like unreasoning animals, by these things they are corrupted. It's a sharp point, Jude's saying. These interlopers, despite their supposed spiritual insights and charismatic pretensions, are slandering things like the angelic realm that they don't truly understand. Their claims arise from a lack of genuine spiritual knowledge.
And the things they do understand.
That's the slam. What they do understand naturally, their basic sensual practices, their cravings and instincts, the kind of knowledge humans share with animals that lack rational faculties, that's what truly corrupts them. Their end is corruption and decay. Like Paul talks about sowing to the flesh.
So it's a deep critique.
It really is. And it's a timely word, I think, for Christians in every age. It's a warning against believing you somehow have greater insight than the writers of the scriptures, or feeling free to just cast off the authority of the apostolic tradition. That path, Jude warns, can lead you to become, well, less than human, more like the unreasoning animals driven by impulse.
You know, diving into ancient texts like this always brings up the fact that the text we read today isn't always perfectly clear-cut. We've touched on it, but this deep dive mentions textual criticism. Can you just explain for us why this sort of messy detective work is so important, especially for a short letter like Jude?
Yeah, messy is a good word for it sometimes, but it's absolutely crucial. Here's why. We do not possess the original first century autographs, the actual documents Jude or Paul or Matthew wrote.
They're lost to history.
Lost to history. What we have instead are literally thousands of New Testament manuscripts. And these represent copies of copies of copies made by hand over centuries.
And mistakes creep in.
Exactly. And the wording in these thousands of manuscripts, well, it differs at many points. Most differences are minor, spelling variations, word order, things like that. But sometimes the variations can affect the meaning. So textual criticism is that painstaking detective work, sifting through all the variants, comparing the manuscripts, trying to figure out the most likely original wording. It's about getting as close as we possibly can to what Jude himself actually wrote.
So what causes these differences, these textual variants? Are they just simple mistakes like typos, or is there more to it?
It's really a mix of things. A lot of changes were accidental, mostly, you know, tricks of the eye for a scribe copying by hand for hours.
I can imagine.
Misspellings, confusing letters that look similar in ancient scripts, accidentally switching the order of words or letters. Maybe they're eye jumps and they skip a word or a whole phrase or even duplicate one. Or sometimes, if texts were being mass-produced by dictation, a scribe might just misconstrue what was being read aloud.
So honest mistakes.
Mostly. But other changes were intentional. Sometimes scribes sought to be helpful. You know, they might make intentional corrections.
Like?
Well, maybe harmonizing the phrasing in one passage with what they remembered from another similar passage, like an Old Testament quote, or matching Mark or Luke more closely to Matthew, or even making one Pauline letter sound more like another.
Trying to make it consistent.
Right. Or sometimes they might combine two different readings they found in different manuscripts they were copying from. That's called conflation. Or they might try to improve the grammar or the style, make it flow better. And yes, occasionally, you even find what look like theologically motivated changes, omissions, alterations, or even insertions.
Okay, so that's where the detective work comes in.
Yeah.
What does a textual critic actually do?
Yeah.
How do they sift through all that and decide, okay, this is probably what Jude originally wrote?
It's a methodical process. They sift through all the variants for a given passage, and they weigh the evidence based on certain principles. Well, first, they give more weight to early manuscripts. Witnesses like Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus from the 4th century, Alexandrinus from the 5th, plus several dozen papyrus copies from the 3rd and even late 2nd centuries, like Papyri 66 or 72. The closer in time to the original, generally the better.
Makes sense. What else?
They also tend to prioritize shorter readings. The thinking is that scribes were generally more likely to add explanatory words or glosses than they were to deliberately omit something.
Okay. Additions are more common than subtraction.
Usually. And they also often prefer the more troublesome reading.
More troublesome? Why?
Because scribes tended to smooth out difficulties. If a reading seemed doctrinally awkward or grammatically clumsy, a scribe might be tempted to fix it. So the harder reading is sometimes more likely to be the original one that caused the later scribe trouble.
Interesting, like psychological profiling of scribes.
A little bit. And finally, they look for wider geographical attestation. If a particular reading shows up in manuscripts that we know came from different parts of the early Christian world, say Egypt, Palestine, and Greece, that suggests it was widely known early on, which gives it more weight.
Okay, let's get specific then. Apply this detective work to Jude verse 5. You mentioned there are two major text critical challenges right there in that one verse. Can you give us the rundown? What are they and why do they matter?
Absolutely. Jude verse 5 presents two really fascinating textual puzzles. The first one involves a Greek word hapax. It means once or once for all, or maybe decisively.
Okay.
The question is, what does it modify? Does it describe Jude's audience having internalized their Christian knowledge, like, you know these things once for all? Several strong early manuscripts support this, like Vaticanus, Alexandrinus, P72. This reading fits well with other New Testament expressions, like in Hebrews 6.4.
That's the alternative.
The alternative reading suggests hapax contrasts what happened first to the Exodus generation with a later failure or judgment. Some manuscripts have this, but it feels a bit more like a stylistic correction a later scribe might make. The first option, describing the audience's knowledge, seems the stronger reading.
Okay, that's one. What's the second challenge in verse 5?
The second one is perhaps even more intriguing. It's the question of who delivered the Exodus generation from Egypt.
Wait, wasn't it God? Or the Lord?
Well, that's one option. One major manuscript, Sinaiticus, says the Lord. Curious. That seems straightforward. But other very important early manuscripts, including Vaticanus and Alexandrinus, and some very early translations into Latin, Coptic, and Ethiopic, giving it really strong support and broad regional attestation, they actually read Isis.
Jesus. They say Jesus delivered Israel from Egypt.
They do. And one early papyrus, Papyrus 72, from around 200 AD, even reads God Christ, Theos Christos.
Wow. What are the implications of that?
It's significant. The reading Jesus is arguably also a more troublesome reading in the technical sense.
Why?
Because Jude doesn't use the name Jesus elsewhere in the letter without adding Christ. So a scribe seeing just Jesus here might be tempted to correct it to the more common Lord or add Christ. It's harder to explain why a scribe would add Jesus if it wasn't originally there.
Jesus might be original.
It's a strong possibility, supported by excellent manuscript evidence. However, if Lord was original, the other variants could be seen as later scribal clarifications or even theological interpretations emphasizing Christ's pre-existence. The bottom line, it is ultimately not possible to be absolutely sure which reading was Jude's original.
So what's the takeaway from that uncertainty?
The main takeaway is that the uncertainty of the textual witness right here, well, it should lead us to remain tentative in any major theological conclusions we might draw based solely on the context of Jude 5. We shouldn't build a whole doctrine on whether Jude wrote Lord or Jesus here. It highlights the complexity, the detective work, and the fact that, yes, there are a few passages where we are left in some doubt as to the exact wording of our lost originals, but the overall message of Jude remains clear.
That's a great point. Okay, so Jude doesn't stop with just historical figures from the scriptures. He keeps building his case. He weaves in these incredibly vivid analogies from the natural world. What else is in Jude's rhetorical toolbox here?
Well, he continues to draw from that established tradition we mentioned, particularly from the Book of 1 Enoch.
Right, the source for the expanded story of the rebel angels.
Exactly. He'd already alluded to it with the Genesis 6 story. Now, remember, 1 Enoch was this really influential Jewish text, technically pseudonymous, meaning written under Enoch's name, but much later. Mm. It actually grew in stages over at least two centuries.
So it was well known.
Oh, yeah. It had an ongoing, steady stream of influence and awareness, especially, it seems, in the circles Jude moved in. The earliest parts, like the Book of the Watchers, that's where the detailed rebel angel story comes from.
And Jude uses it again later.
He does, in verse 13, when he calls the interlopers wandering stars for whom the deepest darkness has been reserved forever.
I remember that image.
That's almost certainly echoing specific references in 1 Enoch, which talks about a prison house for the stars and fallen stars being bound in this place until the completion of 10,000 ages. The connection is pretty clear.
Wow. So 1 Enoch was really important for him.
It seems so. Other parts of 1 Enoch include things like the Book of Heavenly Luminaries, which gets into debates about calendars relevant to the Dead Sea Scrolls community, the Book of Dream Visions, the Letter of Enoch, and the Parables of Enoch, which interestingly talks about a Son of Man figure. Jude clearly valued this parabiblical book, as scholars sometimes call it.
Okay, besides Enoch, he also throws in 3 more specific biblical figures in verse 11. Cain, Balaam, and Korah. What do they have in common? How do they connect to Jude's interlopers?
Yeah, this trio is like a rogues gallery, each representing a distinct facet of the interloper's flaws. First, you have Cain.
First murderer.
Right, from Genesis 4. But the clue for Jude seems to be God's challenge to Cain before the murder. Master your emotions rather than yield to them.
Self-control.
Exactly. This connects directly to the interloper's apparent commitment to gratify rather than master their passions, which Jude hits on multiple times, verses 4, 8, 12, 13, 16, 18. Mastery of the passions was a huge ethical priority for early Christian leaders, especially Paul. Think Galatians 5.
Okay, so lack of self-control. Who's next?
Balaam, the prophet for hire from the Book of Numbers.
The one with the talking donkey.
That's him. But Jude focuses on Numbers 31.16, where Balaam is blamed for advising the Moabite women to seduce the Hebrew men into idolatry. His goal was essentially to dissolve the boundaries around Israel.
I see the connection.
Right. This links to the interlopers promoting sensuality, erasing the boundaries of holiness, and, crucially, their ultimate motive seems to be profit or personal gain, just like Balaam.
And the third one.
Korah. His story is in Numbers 16. He led a rebellion against Moses and Aaron's leadership, claiming that all of Israel was holy to the Lord, basically trying to level the playing field.
Challenging authority.
Precisely. His goal was really to claim some greater measure of authority for himself. His end was quite dramatic, being swallowed up in an earthquake.
A vivid warning.
Very. And this connects directly to the interlopers who, as Jude sees it, pretend to have special access to God, maybe claiming God gave them permissive decrees, all in order to set aside the binding authority of the apostolic teaching and tradition they'd received. They crave authority, but reject accountability.
So beyond these historical villains in Enoch, Jude paints some truly visceral word pictures using nature and industry, I guess. Tell us about that barrage of images he uses to describe the interlopers in verses 12 and 13.
Oh, yeah. He really unleashes a volley of images there. They are not at all flattering, but they're incredibly telling. He calls them...
Let's hear them.
Hidden reefs lurking beneath the surface at their communal love feasts. In a world where shipwreck was a common fear, that's a particularly poignant image.
Right. Suggests hidden danger.
Exactly. It highlights the unseen danger the interlopers pose. Their presence threatens the shipwreck of the faith for the whole community.
Okay, what else?
Shepherds tending themselves. This is a clear echo of Ezekiel's sharp critique of the shepherds of Israel leaders who pose as shepherds but neglect their duty, looking only after their own interests and profits. Their behavior at these Christian love feasts just shows their essential irreverence and self-interest.
Ezekiel.
Waterless clouds being carried along by the wind. This resonates with a proverb, Proverbs 25.1 faith. The idea is that these interlopers are full of air and bluster, you know. Intent on inflating their own reputation, but offering nothing nourishing or helpful, just empty promises.
Like a mirage.
Good analogy. Then, trees bearing no fruit, uprooted twice dead. In autumn, when Jude likely wrote, trees ought to be heavy with fruit. These interlopers are spiritually barren. They have no root sunk into the spiritual nourishment God provides, and so they are dead themselves, incapable of producing life. It's the exact opposite of the righteous person in Psalm 1, the tree planted by streams of water.
Very stark contrast.
Mm-hmm. Then, wild waves of the sea churning up their own shame. This image echoes Isaiah 57, where the wicked are compared to the tossing sea, which cannot rest, whose waves cast up mire and mud. Jude is saying the interlopers' self-indulgent practices just dredge up the mud of their own degradation for all to see.
Powerful imagery in the last one.
The last one we touched on before. Wandering stars for whom the gloom of darkness has been kept in reserve forever. This refers to the planets, the planetai in Greek, which means wanderers. Unlike the fixed stars used for navigation, planets move across the sky in irregular paths.
So they're unreliable guides.
Exactly. Their message and example will lead people astray. And as we said, it circles right back to First Enoch and the rebel angels, punished as fallen stars whose failure to honor God's ordering and boundaries led to their eternal punishment in darkness. Each image is just a concise, damning indictment.
And finally, Jude brings it all together, doesn't he, with a powerful prophecy quoted directly from Enoch itself. What does that passage reveal? What's the final punch?
Right. He lands a heavy blow by directly quoting 1 Enoch chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, and his own verses 14 and 15. He writes, "See, the Lord came with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute judgment on all."
Wait, came? Past tense.
Yeah, that's a little odd, isn't it? The original in 1 Enoch uses the present tense, comes. Jude's use of the past tense came, elfin, is interesting. Maybe it's meant to invoke a historical precedent, or perhaps to emphasize the absolute certainty of the coming judgment, as if it's already happened from God's perspective.
Okay, so what's the rest of the quote?
"To execute judgment on all and to convict everyone of all the deeds of ungodliness that they have committed in such an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things that ungodly sinners have spoken against him."
That's pretty comprehensive judgment.
It is. And notice how Jude cleverly merges the horizons. He takes Enoch's ancient prophecy and claims that Enoch spoke these words either to or about the specific interlopers causing trouble in the audience's present day.
Connecting past and present again.
Exactly. The message is unavoidable. The fate of the watchers, those rebel angels, and the fate of the ungodly swept away in the flood narrative that Enoch also draws on that same fate is reserved for these interlopers and for all those who either persist in or maybe return to a manner of life that does not honor God. Judgment is coming.
So, okay, let's try and wrap this up. As we finish this deep dive into Jude, this short, intense letter, what's the ultimate overarching message he leaves us with? What transcends his ancient context?
Well, I think Jude, from start to finish, has been crafting this incredibly vivid picture. It's a picture of people who use the good news of Jesus Christ and the communities formed around that good news, essentially as a means of profit, a way to advance their own agendas and secure their own satisfaction.
A cautionary tale.
Very much so. He holds up this stark mirror, really. And the ultimate message is a powerful challenge to us, even today. We have to look into that mirror and sincerely hope not to see ourselves reflected there.
But it's not just about condemnation, is it?
No, it's not just that. Jude also reminds us of a facet of God's character that, well, it can be uncomfortable maybe in our modern world sometimes, and that's God's righteous and holy nature, his unwavering commitment to hold his creatures accountable, accountable for the honor and obedience that they owe him.
Which aligns with other teachings.
Absolutely. In this, Jude really echoes Jesus' own teachings about the final sorting, the separation of the righteous from the wicked. It's a serious call to accountability.
But there's grace, too.
Yes. And this is crucial. Amidst all these stark warnings, Jude constantly reminds his hearers, and by extension, us, that they are beloved, not just by Jude himself, but all the more by God. And they are urged actively to keep themselves in God's love.
So warning and love together.
Exactly. And that's maybe the most profound insight. Holiness and love are not conflicting characteristics or opposing options. In Jude's view, and I think in the broader biblical view, they are mutually defining and reinforcing. You keep yourself in God's love by pursuing holiness and contending for the faith. They go hand in hand.
That's a powerful synthesis. So for you, our listener, here's maybe a final provocative thought to mull over as we close. Jude passionately, fiercely defends the boundaries that he believes define authentic faith and practice. Thinking about your own life, your own context, what boundaries might you be tempted to disregard, maybe even believing it's for a good reason, like freedom or progress? How do we discern in our own lives between genuine Christian liberty and what Jude would condemn as mere license? That's perhaps something to explore on your own.